And Battle had 4 strikeouts through his 3 innings, 9 for Jace Barajas through 5. First pitch on the way home, a fastball in there called for strike number 1. 0-1 the count to McCarthy. McCarthy, the left-handed hitting third baseman. It's a lefty-righty matchup. Orez leans back, kicks up and fires, and spikes one in the dirt to bring it even at 1-1. First ball of the inning, that breaks up the potential immaculate inning. 1-1 the count, and home plate umpire wiping off home plate after that one. Bunch of dirt jumped up after the ball bounced in front of the plate. Now ready to go. It's a 1-1 count with one away and the bases empty. Torres brings the pitch home, and a breaking ball can't clip the inside edge. It's a 2-1 count. And McCarthy, 0-2 in the game. He walked back in the fifth inning. Flew out and struck out as well, his other plate appearances. 2-1 count coming home, breaking ball high, 3-1 the count. Torres not able to get the break that he's been hoping for. Started off the count up 0-1, but 3 straight balls, and McCarthy looking to get back on. 3-1 count on the way home, fastball up for ball number 4, and the tying run is now on first base for the Dock Spiders. Well, going back just a couple days ago to the game at Green Bay, and Tony Torres did pitch in that one. Torres came in the ninth inning, and he had allowed 3 runs to the Rockers, although he was able to work out of the game. Jonathan Fitz now up at the plate, and Fitz taking over for Camden Kunke. The first pitch, a swing and a miss for strike number 1, an 0-1 count. A bit of an interesting substitution here, purely for offensive purposes. They are sending in their catcher to take over for the second baseman. 0-1 count, misses low, blocked behind the plate by Garrett, and now a 1-1 count. Runner still on first base is Reese McCarthy. Fitz, a pinch hitter. This is his first plate appearance of the game. Took over for Kunke, who went 1-for-3 on the night. 1-1 the count to Fitz, and the pitch misses in the dirt, picked up by Garrett. Thought about throwing down to first, but he dropped it out of his glove, and now a 2-1 count. McCarthy still over on first base. McCarthy scored the only run of the game for the Dock Spiders back in the fifth inning. He stands on first base representing the tying run. 2-1 the count. And Torres will step off the mound with a disengagement as Fitz will make sure that he's good to go. Fitz batting .256 this season, a .771 on base plus slugging. 2-1 count coming home. It's fouled back. Now 2-2 the count. And Fitz this year, you look at what he's been able to do against the Rafters. He has been really good against Wisconsin Rapids. Certainly been a thorn in the side of the Rafters and trying to get things back in their favor. Two and two the count. And the pitch coming home, once again, is fouled back into the netting. So Fitz stays alive. Two and two the count. Runner on first base and one away. Pitch coming home, it's hit high and straight back out of play. Still 2-2 the count. Runner still on first base, the crowd getting into it here at Hare Baker Field in Fond du Lac. Two and two the count. Breaking ball in there. Called strike 3. got him looking, and that takes care of Jonathan Fitz. Second out of the ninth inning, and the Dock Spiders are down to their last out. Brings up another pinch hitter. And the pinch hitter who comes into the game for the Dock Spiders is Nate McHugh, another catcher for them. They're using all their catchers right now, taking over for Tommy Guggins, Nate McHugh. They're going to have to figure this all out if they can tie it up, but also a home run would walk it off. McHugh, the right-handed hitting pinch hitter, first pitch to him, in there for strike number one, 0-1 the count. Tommy Guggins went 1-for-3 earlier today and had an RBI double. That was the one that sent home Reese McCarthy, but instead opting for McHugh. Righty-righty matchup, 0-1 count, misses outside. Ball one, 1-1. Tying runner still on first base. And Tony Torres looking for his sixth save of the year. 1-1 the count, and Torres, ball and glove, sends it home, gets a swing and a miss. The Rafters are one strike away from getting back in the win column. Nate McHugh trying to be the hero here in Fond du Lac. Has to keep the inning alive. It's a 1-2 count, and Torres will disengage. Steps off to make sure that he's all right. Reese McCarthy over there on first base. And McHugh batting 308 on the season. Pitch comes home. This one's lifted down the left field line and just foul. Oh, man. That would have been trouble. Likely into the corner and very easily could have scored a run. But instead, hooks foul and still a 1-2 count. Garrett Greco is on deck if it gets there, but looks like yet again it would be another pinch hitter for the Dock Spiders. That pinch hitter, Sam Pease. But has to get there first. Runner on first base and a 1-2 count to Nate McHugh. Right-handed hitter from Creighton University. Torres looking to lock down the save. The 1-2 payoff, it's upstairs for ball two. Now 2-2 the count. Torres, two strikeouts in the game. He has tied the Rafters season high. The Rafters as a team, 15 strikeouts as a pitching staff. One more strike and he would break that 2-2 count. Grounded foul down the third base line. Just a tad out of the reach of Luke Skinner. Still a 2-2 count. 15 strikeouts for the Rafters. The only other time they've had 15 strikeouts this season was back on July 2nd against this Dock Spiders team here in Fond du Lac. That was the 10 strikeout game from Noah Marschke. Jace Barajas, 9 in this one. 2-2 the count. Torres looking to finish it off, but misses on the breaking ball outside. 3-2 the count. Torres led the ninth inning off with a strikeout, then walked Reese McCarthy, who stands at first base after Jonathan Fitz also struck out. 3-2 the count, two away, runner on first. Rafters up one in the bottom of the ninth. Runner taking off, swing and a miss, strike number three, and Tony Torres has locked it down for his sixth save of the season. The Rafters back in the win column. Final score, 2-1 in the ninth inning for the Dock Spiders. No runs, no hits, no errors, and one left on base. What a pitcher's duel in this one. A fun matchup from the get-go, and the Rafters end it on top. Once again, the final score, 2-1. A good news Wednesday night. The post-game show comes up next. Rafters looking in the right direction as they have taken a win here on the road. Quick break, and when we come up, it's the post-game show that will return for you here on WFHR. Up next, here on 97.5 FM and 1320 AM.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. In the closet, under the bed, in the car. But I don't want your money or your TV. I can't be scared away or negotiated with. I'm patient and quiet. I don't sleep. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire. And as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Secure all your guns. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party. You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. The craziest thing was believing that your dad knew everything. So as a dad, you felt like you had to know everything. You had to get everything right. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then, you know, it kind of starts to work itself out. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Let's get back to Rafters Baseball here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Well, that was certainly a fun one here from Fond du Lac, as the pitchers certainly impressed for both teams. Noah Chubb on the mound for the Dock Spiders. He went through six innings, a quality start for him. And it's just the second time the Rafters have won a game when the opposing pitcher throws a quality start. So second time this year they've been able to do that, and, well, this time Noah Chubb on the wrong side of it. The Rafters end up getting the win as Justin Battle gets credit for it. He's now 2-0 on the season. Battle is second win of the year. Jace Barajas did pitch deep enough to get credit for the win, but, of course, it was still a 1-1 game when he came out. So could not get the credit for the win. And with that, let's take a look back at the game in total. Let's recap how it all happened. Not much going. It was a shutout all the way up until the fifth inning. Jace Barajas struck out the first five batters that he retired, and he ended up having nine strikeouts through his five innings of work, but the fifth inning did not go his way. He had a leadoff strikeout, then a walk, a 6-3 ground out, and then an RBI double from Tommy Guggins made it 1-0 in the bottom of the fifth for the Dock Spiders. Well, the Rafters did respond in the top of the sixth as soon as they could with an RBI double of their own. Landon Gaz tied it up 1-1 after Madden Akko drew a walk, and then tied 1-1. It would remain that score up until the top of the eighth, and the Rafters in the top of the eighth, they had an RBI bases loaded walk from Eric Harper that made it 2-1, and that was what they needed to put them on top. So 2-1 was the score. Ninth inning comes around, and after Justin Battle went three innings, they turned to Tony Torres, who came in with the save opportunity and got his sixth save of the year. 3 strikeouts for him in the 9th inning. Struck out the side and was able to close it down. 16 strikeouts as a team for the Rafters, a new season high. And with that, the Rafters end up winning it 2-1. Taking a look back at the stats, Royce Clayton Jr., another strong game. He went 2-for-4 with a walk and also stole 2 bases in the game, although looks like they only gave him credit for 1, so we'll have to go back and get that fixed, as Clayton was great throughout the night. And along with that, Arusevic, well, he was able to reach base 1 time. Bo Shane, 1 time on a single. He went 1-for-5. Madden Akko, 1-for-4 in the game with a walk, so he reached twice. Gaz reached twice as well, an RBI double and a hit by pitch. Luke Skinner, 0-for-4, though. But Harrison Garrett reached base 3 times, 1-for-2 on the game with 2 hit by pitches. He continued to just get on base for the Rafters. That's what he does best. Hiroto Kobayashi, batting 8th in the order, he reached twice technically. Once was on a dropped third strike, and the other time, really, on a hit by pitch. Eric Harper also reached twice on 2 walks, going 0-for-2. And on the pitching side, Jace Barajas, 5 innings pitched. He allowed 1 run. It was earned on just 2 hits and 1 walk with 9 strikeouts. Justin Battle then followed him and ended up pitching 3 innings and did not allow a run, allowing just 4 hits, no walks, and 4 strikeouts on the 13 batters that he faced. Tony Torres came in and closed it down. He got the save with 3 strikeouts in that 9th inning, and he walked just the 1 batter that was the second batter of the inning, and that is the game. So the final score, 2-1, and well, with that, let's take a look ahead to next game, where the Rafters will head on the road to Wausau for their game tomorrow night against the Woodchucks. It's going to be the lefty Seth Spencer on the mound for the Rafters, taking on the righty Richie Lessine. And Lessine has already pitched against the Rafters a couple times. Spencer, of course, has already made 10 starts this year. Start number 11 coming up next. Plenty appearances for him, and he's looking to continue his recent strong stretch when he goes on the road to Wausau. But that comes up tomorrow, first pitch at 6:35 p.m., and so we'll have the pregame show coming your way at 6:20 here on WFHR. But that's just about all I've got for you on the postgame show, and a big shout-out has to once again go to the great hospitality of the Dock Spiders. Big shout-out, as always, to Parker Peril, the broadcaster for the Dock Spiders. Always a great guy to get to talk to, and was very helpful in getting things set up. Along with that, shout out to WFHR for hosting us as always, and to the coaching staff of the Rafters for always being helpful and able to answer any of the questions that I might have. One final shout out has to go specifically to Eric Robles, who joined us for the pregame show today. Great to get a chance to talk with him on the pregame interview. But that's about all I've got for thank yous. So many other people that I could thank, but that will do it for our broadcast tonight. So one final time, the Rafters 2, the Dock Spiders 1. From myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, thank you and have a great rest of your night.
Poverty limit will get nothing. And that is, for one person, $62,000. For 2 people, $84,000. For 3 people, $106,000. So if you make more than that, you will get nothing. You will pay the full price without any subsidies for your health insurance. And they're saying it could go up 25%, 75%. I will find out in September when I get my letter. But as a cancer survivor, I have to pay whatever they charge me. I have to pay. Yeah. I can't go without it. So if it costs more than my rent, I still have to figure out how to pay it.
And look, I know they can't deny you for pre-existing conditions, but I assume going forward, especially as we've weakened protections for people, that you know, we can't deny you, but we can charge you to a rate that would be, well, much higher, no?
Right, because I won't qualify for any help, so I am completely at the mercy of the insurance companies for whatever they want to charge me. And an added thing that I will be going through is that next year I turn 50, which I am incredibly grateful to have made it to 50, since that was not a given. People ages 50 to 64 will face the absolute worst of it, the highest rates, because we are too young for Medicare, but we are starting to be at the age in which insurance companies want to charge us more. So yeah, they can't charge me more for being a cancer survivor, but they can charge me more for being 50 and up.
For being old, yeah. When you think weird, because we've got age discrimination laws, but never mind that. But, you know, what I was asking also is, you know, someone in you who went through what you went through, going forward, you know, what chances do they have? Are they going to be left behind? Or you know, as some of the studies that I've seen, are we just ready to let, you know, what was the number I saw? 30,000 people at the high end, 17,000 at the low end, die every year because of, well, 11 million. Was it 11 million people are going to lose health care?
I think the last numbers, and they were editing the bill every day. So I think the last numbers I heard was that 17 million people would lose their health insurance. And that is a combination of people losing their Medicaid, people who can't not being able to afford their Affordable Care Act policies anymore, and so on. So the Affordable Care Act, these price hikes and the lack of help will hit middle class families, self-employed people, people in the gig economy working multiple jobs that don't provide health insurance. It will hit us the most, and Medicaid will hit working class families the most, and people that are caregivers, people that are students, people that are disabled, lower income people the most. So they're going after everybody. They're going after lower income people. They're going after middle class people. The one group of people that they don't seem to be attacking are the billionaires who got their huge tax breaks in this bill.
Boy, did they. So let me ask you this, because you know, we've talked about your pre-existing condition. Are we concerned that at some point down the road, the Republicans are going to go and maybe have a big, beautiful healthcare bill that's going to repeal those kind of protections or weaken protections for people with pre-existing conditions?
Well, I think that they may have learned from 2017 in the fight just how unpopular it was to repeal the Affordable Care Act altogether, you know, because people with pre-existing conditions would be uninsurable. So instead, what they're doing is they are going for a death by a thousand cuts. By making it unaffordable, then they're not taking away health insurance from people with pre-existing conditions. They're just making it so we can't afford it.
And removing us towards a pay or die system, which is what they've always wanted. I've said that for years. So in this big, beautiful nightmare bill, I mean, bring us the wonk. How bad is it? What's in it? What can we expect? What are we not being told? I know there have been talks of, the more you learn about it, the more you're going to like it. I understand this is the more we learn about it, the less we're going to like it. What are we missing?
The important thing is anything that's good in the bill, anything you think that, that sounds like a good idea, it turns out to be very gimmicky. It's only available for some people in some ways, or only your overtime and not your regular. It's very gimmicky, not available to everybody. And second, it's time limited. It's going to expire in the next few years. But the tax cuts for billionaires and corporations, that's forever. So
as it should be. It should be, because we need a billionaire class, Laura. We need the biggest billionaire class ever. We need to tighten the belts a little bit more. We need to eat box mac and cheese. We need to do everything we can to enrich our corporate masters, because that's evidently what's important.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they're going to make Medicaid near to impossible for many people to keep. And they're saying, we're not cutting Medicaid. We're just getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse. If they wanted to go after waste, fraud, and abuse, they could go after the $1 trillion that insurance companies are getting off of Medicare Advantage, overbilling the taxpayers. Instead, they're going after individuals on Medicaid and making it impossible for you to jump through all those hoops to keep your health insurance, because they know more than 90% of people on Medicaid work or are full-time caregivers, but they are counting on it being so hard to stay enrolled that people will give up, just like that's what happened in Georgia when they tried it.
Right.
And Arkansas.
No, but here's the thing. As a stage 4 cancer survivor, you're the waste. you're the fraud, you're the abuse. That's their definition of it. Giving people health care, especially when they need it at their most desperate hour, it appears to be. I don't know what's actually in their soul. I just know what's in their policy. That seems to be the waste, fraud, and abuse. People like you, people who need it, getting the care that they need.
Well, also, an insurance card doesn't cost anything besides a few cents to create it and mail it. Medicaid has some of the lowest reimbursement rates compared to Medicare and other programs. It's the most cost-efficient way of providing care. So the way you save money from Medicaid is you kick off people that are using Medicaid. You know, if somebody is in their basement eating Cheetos, playing video games, they are costing $0 to our healthcare system. It's the people that have chronic diseases, that are disabled, that are in nursing homes on Medicaid. These people are the ones that are costing Medicaid because Medicaid is paying for their care. You only save money if you get rid of people that need care, that cost money.
Which, again, I go back to the some of the studies that I've seen anywhere. I think it's between like 17,000 and 30,000, if I remember right, people who are going to die each and every year, somewhere in that range, because of the lack of health insurance, not going to doctors to get preventative care, not following up on care that you need, not taking the drugs that you need, not doing the maintenance that needs to happen. And ultimately, I would argue costing our system much more as illnesses get much worse. And, you know, we use the ER once again as the family doctor.
Mm-hmm. Right. That is the most expensive way to provide care. So if you are making it so that more people don't have health insurance, they will get their care in the costliest way, in later stages of diseases where it is more expensive or impossible to cure them. And also, cutting this much money out of the system means hospitals will close, and that affects everybody. And maybe your hospital doesn't close, but all the people that went to the hospital that's closed are now going to your hospital too. Yeah.
No, and what I've been saying, and what's resonated with some folks is, you know, look, I've got the best healthcare money can buy in this country. We are at the top, the Cadillac plans, they used to call it, because my union negotiates for it. But what good is having that card that doesn't cost a lot of money to produce if there's no hospital or a healthcare system to go to use it, or if I've got to go hours away? It just seems that this is, you know, what did Ben Franklin always, what did he say, you know, penny wise, pound foolish. This seems like a whole lot of that.
Exactly. But the billionaires need their tax cuts, Rick. So,
of course.
I mean, one of their goals is to force people, whether they are able to work or not, force people with disabilities, force people that are caregivers, force people that are dealing with chronic conditions back out in the workforce, because all of the people that have deported, that are picking vegetables and doing construction work and so on, those jobs still need to be done. Yeah. So how about you force people who are going through medical crises to do those jobs?
Yeah. And what we just talked about a minute ago, how about we just we deregulate those industries, make them less safe, so we can attract literally nobody to them. Last question I've got for you, you know, as founder and organizer there with Voices of Healthcare Action, you're out there talking to people. Are folks getting what just happened? Is there a sense of in your mind, is there a sense that we know how bad this is? And if not, you know, what should people know, and how should they organize around it?
Well, hospitals are already starting to close. A hospital in Nebraska already announced, and we will see more and more of those over the next couple years. The Medicaid cuts theoretically don't kick in until after next year's election. I wonder why. But already hospitals are closing because they know they don't have those funds that they can count on. And states have to balance their budgets. So states are going to have special sessions this year, maybe, and sessions next year, where they figure out how to deal with these cuts. So Medicaid cuts, slow motion. The really bad stuff is coming in a little while. Affordable Care Act is right now. We're going to start getting letters in the mail in September with the new rates for next year. And assuming that Congress doesn't solve the problem of the missing subsidies, it's going to be gigantic. So people are going to get those letters in September, going to take effect January, the new rates. So that's happening real soon.
Yeah. And look, they didn't have to kill Obamacare and by legislation. They're just going to starve it of the resources that it needs to exist. So folks don't get the care that they need and the insurance that they as a citizen, I think you deserve, earn, however you want to frame that. Laura, I appreciate the time. Great work. Voices of Healthcare Action. You can check out Laura Packard's website at laurapackard.com. Laura, as always, great stuff. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Want to hear your thoughts. It's bad, isn't it? And what part of it is going to affect you, or don't you know yet? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Heat advisory this evening. Occasional cloudiness for tonight with a few showers and thunderstorms around. Some strong with heavy rainfall. Warm and muggy with lows in the low 70s. Partly sunny for tomorrow, scattered storms, highs into the mid-80s. Currently, it's 72 degrees.
This message is for Karina, our mom who finished her high school diploma at age 28. Hi, Mom. It's Amethyst and Nicholas.
Congratulations on getting your diploma.
You worked so hard and have taught us so much.
We love you.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, nobody wants to read about Donald Trump anymore. There are a couple of Trumpite books out there written by the Pragers of the world and some of the other right-wing columnists. And they're going nowhere. And that's a good thing. Maybe we're just tired of reading about the insanity that's going on right in front of our eyes. And maybe we've wakened up and we want to look for something, well, worth reading. And that's why I'm thrilled to have my next guest come on the program. You may remember Dr. Keith during the pandemic. He was my go-to medical guy because at the time it was an emergency room physician. Was a doctor healing people during the pandemic. Well, he decided that, you know what, I have another calling, became a middle school teacher, and has written a great book called Tickled Soul, The Philosophical Journey of a Doctor-Turned-Middle School Teacher. Dr. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's been a while. Great to see you again.
It has been a while, but my buddy Keith Pocheck has written a great book. I highly suggest people go out and get it and read it. So let's start with the obvious. You are a physician. You're a doctor. You went to school. You did all of that stuff to get that degree, to have that esteemed pedestal of healer and chief. And you gave all that up to teach middle school students. Why?
that's the question that I got the most in the first few months after I started and jumped in with both feet and went full time teaching. And so appropriate that you asked that. And it really is what compelled the book itself, just because I felt like for a while I was answering with, well, it's complicated. And that just didn't seem to be an adequate answer for most people and for me either. So why I made the jump? I think over the years, in emergency medicine and in urgent care medicine, where I worked for almost exactly 20 years, I wasn't getting the satisfaction from the job that I previously did, and there was a multitude of reasons, and some of those were things that changed about me, and a lot of those were things that changed about the system itself. But so I really just kind of took things back to square one and said, well, let's start with what I actually believe. And a lot of that's maybe even more philosophical and religious at the beginning anyway. Is it now different than what it was when I was younger? And it is. Those things have evolved and changed. And I think when what you actually believe starts to morph and starts to change and take on a little bit of a new shape, it's going to change your identity and even your purpose to a degree. And so I just sort of let myself explore that through various phases of my life and through various phases of my career, and was able to get a lot of it onto paper, and, you know, spent about the course of almost an entire year from sitting down and initially starting the manuscript and having no idea where it was going to go and let it meander. And then toward the final endpoint of having a publisher release it, just like they did today. And it was a certainly an educational experience for me. Got to work with some great people who walked me through a process that I wasn't familiar with really at all. And I'm happy, and I hope that I hope that some folks find some inspiration from it.
Yeah, I mean, we had talked numerous times over the last several years, and a big part of it, at least from my perspective, when I saw the book was coming out. Because you struggled with the changes in the healthcare industry. You struggled with, the corporatization, and it really wasn't as maybe I shouldn't testify for you. What was it that made you kind of move away? What were you dealing with? Because look, this is more than just a memoir. It's framed as a philosophical journey. So, what questions were you wrestling with personally, professionally, that led you in this direction?
I think that there was a few years into my career, I don't know that it was a single awakening or just a series of them, but I wasn't feeling the thrill of competence anymore that I think that people get when they have learned a new craft. When that happens, like during residency, which was a 3-year process at a really busy hospital, emergency department in an urban setting, you spend so many hours there and you see so many thousands of cases and you do these procedures over and over and over. And then, a couple years in, you kind of are one of the go-to people to fix things and to take on challenging situations and, get an airway in someone when other folks are struggling or, getting dislocated bones back into place. And there's a real thrill with that. But at some point, probably, I don't know, 8-10 or so years in, that thrill of competence wears off. Like, I think maybe that I would compare it to, this isn't a fair comparison because I'm not a pilot, but I would say somebody that learns how to fly a plane, that there probably becomes a time where that's no longer nearly as thrilling, and now you're just kind of going through the process again.
So it's almost like you start to see factory work then.
Yeah, and then you start to see really a little some more of the illnesses of the system itself that maybe start to have you preoccupied, and then maybe there's an internal search there or a bit of an identity crisis like I went through. To compel you to look for some other avenues that may be more fulfilling.
Because when I read through this, I'm going, most people, aren't able in the middle of their working lives to go, this thing I've been doing for 20 years, I spent my entire life to get to this point. I'm at the top of my profession. Most people don't have the one financial ability to make that shift. And two, aren't mentally ready to start all over again and work their way up from the bottom. So I think that's a testament to your character, but also on the financial side, how's your wife taking this? I mean, I know she's a doctor as well, but that's from doctor to middle school teacher, that's gotta be a financial hit.
Oh, it definitely was. I mean, it was a tectonic shift. And, you know, every day I'm grateful for her patience and grace in the process. You know, luckily, I was at a point where I'd paid off my loans, and we got to a point where we owed on the house and, you know, wanted to fund our kids' education. And we didn't really owe really much money elsewhere. So for me to even be able to consider that, I know is just presented an incredible opportunity that most people just don't get to have.
Yeah.
And so, a huge upside to that is that I can go into work and view it as as the blessing that it is, that I was able to, you know, that I was afforded this opportunity. And I think hopefully that outlook, that perspective sort of shows when I'm teaching. I hope.
Yeah. Two things. One, why tickled soul? What is that? And the other part of this is it's kind of an introspection, a part narrative, part introspection. What are you hoping people get from it? You know, teachers, doctors, either or, neither, both. What do you hope they take away from it about purpose, burnout, or just rediscovering the joy of work?
Well, the term tickled soul came from an actual physical sensation that I started to recognize I would get when I was able to, and it started in medicine when I was working in the ER, when I was able to arrive at a truth, when I was able to figure something out and provide some measure of either comfort or relief or closure or something for a patient that they appreciated, that I actually would get a physical sensation that was kind of right at the base of my skull, back of my neck, and would maybe radiate a little upwards and downwards and to each side a slight bit. And it was pleasant. It wasn't an uncomfortable, just almost kind of a tingling feeling. And, you know, I still remember the first case where I actually recognized it, that what was provoking it. You know, there was a lady who thanked me for, you know, arriving at a kind of a complex diagnosis and said, you know, I really appreciate what you just did for me. I know that I'm not easy to figure out, and you spent the time and you listened to me and you figured it out. And that I was walking back to my computer after that conversation, and I felt that, and I said, just made a mental note of it. But then in the coming months and years, it would happen again in a similar situation where I would get a validation of why I was doing what I was doing. And I'm sure that there's a physiologic explanation for it. I don't know that I fully understand it, but neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin getting released. So I don't know that I could explain the complexities of the physiology behind it, but I know that there's that certainly exists. But I started to realize that, hey, those validating moments and that feeling is really what the reason that you work, that you do what you do. And I started to feel it when residents and nurse practitioners and PA students and medical students were working with me and would pick up a nugget of knowledge and be grateful, or they would understand a concept and be grateful. And so I learned then that teaching could provide the same, you know, just source of satisfaction and validation.
No, that's
even though the healthcare system was crumbling and my work environment was headed the wrong way for years, that there were going to be other ways I could kind of activate that feeling and get that validation.
Yeah, you were finding joy in your work, the reason that you woke up that morning. And I can see how one would translate to the other, because my question was going to be is, you know, you went from being a doctor, you still are clearly, but you know, you went from that being your profession of meeting people usually on their worst days, usually on bad days, to, you know, children who are filled with you know, with opportunity and potential in all of those things. So I can see a transition being somewhat more rewarding personally, if not definitely not financially. But right. I can see how that works.
Yeah, you know, and I just and I explore this some in the book because I think that for whatever reason, I've always felt like that I've had this abundance, and I don't want to say that I've lived an opulent, abundant life. There are stages of my life where it certainly wasn't that, but there was always enough. Like you know, I didn't miss meals, even if what I had to eat wasn't maybe my favorite. I drove a car that was beat up and shared it with my sister. And sure, we worked, but we were never, you know, anywhere. We certainly never felt like we were anywhere near impoverished. So I've just kind of had this sense that it's going to be okay. And I have this abundance that, you know, it's a responsibility of that to do what you can to share it and try and perpetuate it.
No, because look, Keith, you know, the reality is I'm sure most people are watching going in a time where, you know, we're so focused on getting more. I want more income. I want more goods. I want more things. I want easier this or that. To see someone just for the joy of life going, you know what, I'm not happy doing what I'm doing that provides me all of these other opportunities. I want to do something that makes me happy, kind of a big deal. And in a time when many people feel stuck or burnt out in jobs or careers, your story to me offers a model for reinvention, if you will. So the question I have is, what advice would you give to someone who's considering maybe not as major of a professional shift as you undertook, but one that bucks expectations or norms?
I'll repeat a phrase that I said on a podcast that I did with a fellow named Lon Stroshine about, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago or so, that kind of struck him. It was, you know, if you're in that phase, guilt can kind of overwhelm you. Just the thought that you're thinking of leaving, and you have these sunk costs. You know, you've spent this time and this money, and the blood, sweat, and tears to get where you are, and you know you're pretty successful, and now you have a family, and you have some other burdens, and you have some other responsibilities, and so you almost feel guilty to even be considering leaving that. It feels irresponsible. And I was in a position, fortunately, that, you know, once I involved my wife in some of the thought process and decision-making and planning, because I sat with that for a long time, for a number of years, where I thought it was really just a phase that I was going to be able to outlast, something that was temporary. And then at some point I realized it wasn't that anymore. And that I needed to pursue a change. But I think the nugget that I would give is that you shouldn't let your guilt overcome your curiosity. You know, find some ways to explore it, even if it just means to volunteer for a few hours or to go to a seminar somewhere and meet some people and talk to some folks. You know, I put my name on the substitute teacher list, which was in the early phases of how this all started. And this was during a brutal wave of COVID. So they needed me any day I wanted to work. You know, I mean, it was just like, basically, look, you don't wait on us to call you. If you have a day that you're available and you want to work, just show up. We'll find you. But I mean, COVID would go through a department, and that was back when we were quarantining ourselves for 10 days or 2 weeks. So they, you know, they would need you for an extended amount of time. And being able to do that and just being able to work with the young people every day, I think is really just what made the path even that much more clear.
Yeah.
That and this is what I was going to do for a living. So, but you have to kind of allow yourself to get into that, exploring phase, and realize that it doesn't necessarily commit you to anything, and it's not a jump out of an airplane and pull the ripcord and hope the parachute opens. The phase has to last a little longer than that, and it has to be a little more intentional.
Yeah, no, and I didn't know the part that you had signed up for a substitute. I'm sure that's in the book. But you hit on something that grabbed my attention. You said, because, you know, guilt keeps you in a lot of places. And look, I went through that myself for years. You know, I've done a job for years, and I'm still doing that job because it pays the bills. It keeps a roof over from the kid's head. And it's what I thought what I have to do. It's where I make my living. But the idea of going and doing something else has been that guilt that's held me. And I know a lot of other men, and I know probably women too, but from this society, a male standpoint, or at least of my generation, I can see how that guilt would be overwhelming and preclude you from doing anything other than what's putting food on the table.
Absolutely. And this wouldn't be to judge someone who feels like, hey, I can't make this work. I don't intend to do that at all. I was in a very enviable, rare position to be able to do this. And yet
were a doctor. You were the guy, you were the guy everybody looks to. So in this society, in this economy, you were right up there at the top, which is sad to say, because I think teachers should be right there as well.
Agreed. I mean, what's more important? You just watch as the funding for education continues to be threatened and withheld, and it's an infuriating place, and it's sometimes hard not to just to look at the trajectory of the way things are headed and just say, hey, you know, we're never going to pull out of this. This is going to crash and burn. And I developed it, and this is another philosophical sort of place where I've landed, is that it's just all of these battles are forever. They're eternal. They're going to last forever. There'll be setbacks. There will be advances. There will be small victories, and there'll be losses. But it's, you know, we're never going to achieve complete equality. We're never going to eradicate poverty completely. We're never going to establish good healthcare for every person on earth. But that doesn't mean that we stop fighting those battles.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, they're just going to go on forever. If you can help an individual person, if you can empower an individual person to help pull themselves out of poverty, you're advancing this cause that lasts forever. So it can be a little discouraging that, you know, that these battles will never be won. But I think the other side of that is that they'll never be fully lost either. So it's just a matter of carrying them on and finding some inspiration in the places where you find them, and then hoping to inspire other people to do the same thing.
As I always say, you know, you want to change the world, start with your little corner of it. But Keith, great book. I hope folks will take a look at it. Tickled Soul, The Philosophical Journey of a Doctor Turned Middle School Teacher. You can get that at warrenpublishing.net right now in the pre-order section. You can get that, and we'll get links out on social media. Dr. Keith Pochick, I appreciate the time. Great work. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks again for having me.
My good friend, Dr. Keith Pochick. Again, check out the book, Tickled Soul, warrenpublishing.net, where you can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you thinking of career change? Thinking of something maybe radical, like, I don't know, going from doctor to middle school teacher? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day that a mob began an attack on Chinese workers in San Francisco that killed 4 people. During the mid-1870s, a depression swept across the nation. White workers from the East Coast headed west, many to San Francisco, hoping to find a job. Skilled Chinese workers who had completed their labor on the Transcontinental Railroad also came to the city. There, the Chinese laborers found work in trades like cigar making and also open laundries. Resentment against the Chinese workers grew in the city's white working class. In the summer of 1877, workers on the East Coast railroads walked off their jobs after their wages were cut repeatedly. A wave of labor militancy washed over the nation.
Historians often refer to that summer as the Great Upheaval, a time where capital and labor literally battled in the streets. In San Francisco, the Working Men's Association, a socialist workers' organization, called for a rally in front of City Hall. The meeting began with speeches against the titans of capital. But soon, a group of angry workers began to demand speakers, quote, talk about the Chinese. A mob stormed off to terrorize Chinese residents. They burned 20 Chinese laundries. After the violence ended the next day, the anti-Chinese rhetoric continued. An Irish-born freight handler by the name of Dennis Kearney became the vocal leader of the call that the Chinese must go. Adherence to the anti-Chinese cause came to be known as Kearneyism. The backlash against Chinese workers spread beyond California. In 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. Solidarity of workers had fallen to racism. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, Keith, a dear friend, been a friend for a long time, and I remember, look, him going through his journey, and a big part of it being that thing that you know, I think all of us struggle with. How do we find a job that, a path that we find rewarding, that's more than just putting food on the table and a roof over our heads? How do we find satisfaction in our work? And look, you know, there's that old saying, how does it go? If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. There is that. And you know, I look at my journey through the healthcare system and the people that I've, you know, come across, the burnout is real. And especially when you're talking about the high stakes of both careers that he has chosen, the healthcare field and education, the consequences are so great. The stakes are so high. And I understand. I do. You know, I've had conversations with some friends who are like, yeah, I don't get why you'd give up being a doctor and the prestige and the money and all of that just to become a teacher. And you go, look, all of us have been influenced by people who their calling was to become a teacher. And, you know, the more I've wrestled with this idea, the more I think we've in this country have got it really backwards and really wrong, which is why Scandinavian countries have a much higher life satisfaction, have a better out. The happiness index seems to be much higher in those places because they treat teachers as actual professionals. And not just in words like essential or frontline hero or any of that stuff, but actually the dignity of being able to support themselves. Because one of the things that I had to, you know, before I had Keith on the program, I'm like, you know, so what's it like? You know, are you struggling to put school supplies and struggling to do all of the things that we hear? And the reality is he's in a fortunate position. He did well during his doctoring years, didn't live beyond his means. His wife has a good income. So things are good. And it's the kind of thing you want for every working person, the kind of stability, which is why I think the book is well worth a good read. And in this day and age, you know, I'll be honest with you, something that's uplifting, something that's inspiring, something that's, you know, off of the beaten track, well worth it. And that's why I say, you know, take a look at Tickled Soul, The Philosophical Journey of a Doctor Turned Middle School Teacher. I think it's well worth the read and, you know, the thought that goes into it, you know. So good on Keith. I wish him nothing but the best. Hope the book does wildly well. And I hope in this country that we start thinking about, you know, what kind of a future do we want for ourselves, for our children? What kind of vocations do we want for our kids? It's an interesting topic, and I appreciate Keith from coming on and talking about it. I want to hear about your journey. Let me know. You identify? Don't identify? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Or if you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always,
Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Columbia University is paying the Trump administration to restore federal funding. CBS's Matt Piper in New York.
Columbia University will pay out $221 million after violating Jewish student civil rights on campus. The resolution comes after 4 months of negotiations between the Ivy Leaguer and the Trump administration. The payout will restore federal research money that was canceled in the name of combating anti-Semitism. Columbia has also agreed to submit to independent monitoring to ensure it's complying with merit-based hiring and admissions requirements.
A federal judge bans the Trump administration from taking Kilmara Brego Garcia into immediate immigration custody if he's released from jail in Tennessee while awaiting trial on human smuggling charges. The judge has ordered the U.S. government to provide 3 business days notice if it seeks deportation proceedings against him. CBS's Jake Rosen.
A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson attacked the judge in Maryland for her.